where in the second of the 7 points in this mind training text, the main practice, the second point of the two bodhicittas, the conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. And we're looking at now the ultimate bodhicitta, which of course is the wisdom practice, the practice of coming to realize emptiness, to realize that nothing exists independently. And we've been looking at the first point there, trained to view all phenomena as dreamlike. So here in this mind training text, it talks about first meditating to come to see that all phenomena are dreamlike in terms of the objects. And now what we see, the next slogan here, it says, next, the meditation on the absence of intrinsic existence of perceiving subjects is presented in the following line. And it says here, examine the nature of the unborn awareness. So what we often find is that certainly within the Kagyu and Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, when they come to do this Vipassana practice within the context of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, their main focus is on the mind itself. And so this is the second point here, is focusing on the mind itself. Whereas we this morning had a look at initially focusing on ourself as the person. So this is within the Lam Rim context, is what is often recommended as a starting point for the Vipassana practice, to look at ourself, the person. Is there a person here to be found or not? Is there an independently existent person? So let's have a look at the commentary on that slogan, examine the nature of the unborn awareness, and see what it means. It says, contemplate thus, similar to the preceding meditation, the very mind that negated the intrinsic existence of the perceived objects, one, in terms of its past, is no more, two, in terms of its future, is yet to be, and three, in terms of its present is composed of three parts. It is devoid of colour, shape, and spatial location. It cannot be said to be located in any specific point of the body when analysed. It is empty of all identifiable characteristics. The perceiving mind, too, abides as primordially unborn. So there's a few things to say about this. First here, when it says unborn, primordially unborn, it means it's not inherently produced. When we look at, in our Vipassana practice, when we investigate something, we can investigate from at least three different perspectives. And these are called the three doors of liberation. Three doors of liberation are emptiness, signless, wishlessness. So when we investigate how something exists, we can, as we did earlier, in terms of the person, we can investigate the object itself directly. So that's the door of liberation of emptiness, where we are investigating the entity of the object itself. Is there a person to be found here? Is there a a bowl to be found here in the basis. So that the approach is we're looking directly. But here, when we talk about something being unborn, we're talking about it not being inherently produced. And that is this second door of liberation, signlessness, where there's no sign of inherent, it's not inherently produced. So this is talking about looking at emptiness from the perspective of the cause. And in Nagarjuna's classic text, this Mula Majjhimika Karika, which is the foundation of this Majjhimika philosophical system, the very first verse in that text, he says, nothing anywhere is ever produced from itself, from something other, from both, or without a cause. So there, the reasoning or the approach is this one, that nothing is inherently produced, or it's unborn here. But also we can look at in terms of the result, which is wishlessness. And the idea of wishlessness is there's no result to wish for. There's no inherently produced result. But as a beginner, generally, this is the easier approach, to look at the thing itself, rather than try to look at from the perspective of, is it inherently produced? Does it inherently produce a result? And here, there's a few things it says, talks about the mind. The first, it says, one reasoning we can use in terms of looking at the mind itself is that this first part in the commentary here, we can talk about the continuum of the mind. And we can talk about past, present, future. So let's say this is sort of the present moment. We're sort of expanding a little bit. So can you find the mind? Is the mind findable? The past, it ceased to exist. So that is not there. The future is yet to come, so that doesn't exist. And as the text here says, it says, in terms of its present, it's composed of three parts. So the present moment, which is the only thing that exists, we can divide into three parts. The beginning, the middle, and the end. And so then we can use the same reasoning with that and say the beginning has ceased to exist. The end is yet to come. That doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is the middle part, which also could be divided into three. And so we can keep doing that. We can keep going down, 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 and we'll never find the present moment. So the mind is not findable. That's one way of doing it, that you cannot find the present moment. And then also here, it says, and this is the approach that we used a little bit this morning and we'll use again tomorrow morning, that it is devoid of colour, shape and spatial location. It cannot be said to be located in any specific point of the body when analysed. It is empty of all identifiable characteristics. So this is often the approach used in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen. When we come to the Vipassana practice, we ask these sorts of questions. And where is the mind? Where is it located? Does it have a particular shape? Does it have a particular colour? Does it come from somewhere? Is it abiding somewhere? Does it go somewhere? Does it have any identifiable characteristics at all? So we do these sorts of analysis to come to realise that the mind also is empty of independent existence, that we cannot find the mind. And so this is the approach used here. And so it says, the perceiving mind too abides as primordially unborn.
Sorry. Can we say that consciousness and mind are the same? And,
So
private mind is like identified consciousness.
So in general, if we speak very generally, Mind, consciousness, awareness, synonymous. They mean exactly the same thing in general. Mm-hmm. When we talk in specific contexts, as we're going to do a little bit later this afternoon, sometimes these words can take on a little slight different meaning. For example, we're going to look at the five aggregates. The fifth aggregate is normally translated as consciousness. There, the consciousness is not the same as mind. Example. Also, in the Kagyu Nyingma school, where they really always a lot talk about the, we can talk about three levels of mind. The mind that's active now is the coarse mind. But we have deeper levels of mind, subtle and very subtle. And this is what we're trying to gain access to in Tantra or Vajrayana practice. Often within the Kagyu and Nyingma school, they only use the word awareness for this. And they only use the word mind for this. So in those traditions, mind and awareness are mutually exclusive. If it's one, it can't be the other. So what we need to be careful of is the context where we see these words. And it's very difficult to understand how the person is using it if we don't understand the context. Then we can just get a lot of confusion. And unfortunately, this word awareness is very popular now, and it's often used to mean other things as well. It's often used to translate other Sanskrit words as well. For example, we looked at the shamatha practice. The two main tools we use in shamatha is mindfulness to hold the object, and then introspection to quality control, to check, monitor. Introspection, some translators translate that as awareness. They say mindfulness and awareness, and then we get confused. What are they talking about when they're actually talking about introspection? So what I'm suggesting is we need to be very careful when we see these words, what the context is and how the person's using it. Otherwise, we're just going to get thoroughly confused. But generally here, these are equivalent. They mean the same thing when we're talking very general here.
Possible to make such a comparison, like for a computer to function, there is need to this metal box and the power, like electric power, and the data what is coming from internet. And for me to be an independent entity, I need this body. To be independent entity, like to function in the world.
Nothing exists independently.
Okay, I agree. Like, this body needs like
food and water,
electric power, and also needs the consciousness or mind. Like,
yeah. So, a person, of course, has a body and a mind, and the mind, the coarse mind that is active now, needs as a support or interface the body, particularly the brain and the sense faculties. Without that basis, the coarse mind cannot operate in this world. But of course, we're not saying that the mind can be subsumed or is equivalent to the brain. The brain is like the support or the interface for the mind, the coarse mind.
And we need prana also, like a subtle body or energy.
As the basis for the subtle and very subtle mind. Yes. The basis of the coarse mind is this body with the brain and everything. The basis of the subtle mind is subtle body, and the basis of subtle, very subtle mind is very subtle body. Very subtle body is very subtle wind energy in the heart chakra. Always come together. Always come together. Here, then, Chikawa is coming from Nyingma background, So here in the commentary, when we're talking about this unborn awareness, this is often, as I said, another name for this very subtle mind. So therefore we see here, the perceiving mind too abides as primordially unborn. So I think here in the commentary, this is referring to this very subtle mind, very subtle clear light mind. But also, of course, we can interpret this, examine the nature of the unborn awareness at the coarse level of our mind. That our mind, this coarse mind or awareness, is not inherently produced. We cannot find the coarse mind. So it can apply to both. You can have both interpretations here. Any questions?
Yeah, I understand the present moment. If you go intellectually to find it, we won't find this moment, but we can experience it. This is what we experience.
Correct.
When we're sitting here, right?
And you can experience the bowl. Can you find the bowl there?
I can experience it.
Same thing, isn't it? I mean, we're experiencing the bowl. So again, we're not saying that the mind doesn't exist. We're not saying the present moment doesn't exist. We're just saying you can't find it. Therefore, it doesn't inherently, independently exist. Just like the bowl, we can experience the bowl, but if we search for the bowl in the basis, you can't find it, which means the bowl is not inherently existent. It does not exist independently.
So should I just stop thinking about the ball and experiencing the ball? I mean,
so there's two things here. There's what's called conventional analysis and ultimate analysis. Conventional analysis goes, oh, here's a bowl. This is a bowl. It can hold some water. I can wring it. That's conventional. Mm-hmm. Ultimate analysis is, how does that bowl exist? How is that existing? So when we experience the bowl, that's just a conventional mind. We're just experiencing the bowl, and that's fine. There's no problem there. The problem is how we grasp onto it actually existing. That's the problem. So the ultimate analysis is not just noticing a bowl and saying, oh, yes, that has a nice ring to it, and we can put some liquid in there and that. That's okay, but what we're interested in here is, how does that exist? And that's what we're doing here in the Vipassana practice, is looking at, how does the bowl exist? How do I exist? How does the mind exist? How does the present moment exist? Not whether or not there's a present moment. Of course there's a present moment. And we can experience the present moment, just like we can experience the bowl. No problem. The question is, can we find the present moment? Can you find the bowl there?
So are there also an ultimate analysis, two approaches? I can try to intellectualize the ultimate analysis, like using my intelligence, or can I use my experience? Can I approach?
You need both.
Okay.
We need the intellectual to have a framework for the practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we didn't have this intellectual understanding that we're trying to build up now, and then someone says, you know, find out how you exist, you'll go, well, how do I do that? What am I doing? I don't know. You have no idea. You'd have no idea how to go about it. And also, if you did some investigation and you had a certain experience, you'd go, what does that mean? You would have no idea on how to interpret it. For example, as I mentioned earlier, in the emptiness practice, the one we went through, very common experience is people have a lot of fear, because often they haven't really studied. They have no intellectual understanding that when they do the search, and if they don't find, it means actually there's no independent me, as opposed to no me at all. So that's why when people who haven't got an intellectual framework often do this practice, they freak out, because they think they're going crazy or they're going out of existence, because they're misinterpreting the experience of not finding. So we need a framework to know what to do and how to evaluate various experiences. Otherwise, what are we going to do? But we need more than that, of course. And there's a nice analogy that I like to use, is the map is not the territory. Meaning, if we want to go and investigate an unknown territory, it'd be good to have a map. Otherwise, we go in there and we get completely lost, go round and round and round and get lost. So we need to develop a map. Otherwise, what are we going to find? We just get lost. But we can have the best map in the world and still not know what's in the territory, because we have to go and look. So we can do all this intellectualizing and be the smartest Buddhist philosopher in the world and be completely miserable, because the map is not the territory. So we need both. We need to develop a map so we know what to look for and how to look and so forth. But then we need to go and look. So here, we need to develop an intellectual understanding of emptiness, dependent arising, how to do the practice and so forth. But then we've got to do the practice. Because we have to come to directly experience how we exist, how the mind exists. Because this ignorance that is the root of suffering is a very strong habit. We need a very strong antidote to eliminate it. And the only antidote is a direct realization of nature of reality in meditation. That's the only thing strong enough to wipe it out. A good intellectual understanding won't even really touch it. Won't touch it.
Morning, you said spoke about regret and guilt.
Yeah.
And deconstructed guilt, like it's destructive.
It's useless.
Useless.
Yeah.
And what is fear? Like we speak about fear a lot, and what is fear like?
Yeah. I mean, of course, some types of fear are useful. They help protect us from danger and so forth. But this here, this sort of fear is irrational fear. It's irrational fear. It's a bit like when we're young and we thought there was a monster under our bed or something, we got frightened. And then the mum had to come and turn on lights and go, look, there's no monster there. That's irrational fear. It's not based in reality. And so the fear here in this meditation is completely irrational fear. It's not based in reality.
So how to eliminate it?
By understanding that there's no monster under the bed. By understanding that not finding doesn't mean I don't exist. By producing a better map so that when we encounter something in the territory, we go, oh, I know what that is. Yeah.
Just to clarify the point, conventional analysis is like I take the cup of water with it, I see what I can do with something.
And yeah,
ultimate analysis is how does it come into being, how does it exist?
Yeah, okay. Ultimate analysis is how does that thing exist?
Okay.
Conventional analysis just goes, what can I do with that? You know, I can put some water in it and it's nice sound to it and it's made of some sort of metal. And
which are the terms in ultimate analysis for intellectual understanding and understanding through experience? Like those two ways, like drawing the map?
It's those three stages we looked at in Tibetan, gol, nyam, tok. Gol means intellectual, nyam means taste or experience, and tok means realization. Okay. If we go on to the next point then, it says, next, the meditation on the absence of the intrinsic existence of phenomena is presented by the following line. The remedy too is freed in its own place. And this also can be interpreted in two ways, which we'll look at shortly. Thus, the very mind that performs the act of applying the remedies through experiencing the emptiness of all phenomena, including your body and mind, is not established. So the mind we use to come to realize emptiness of the body or the person or whatever we're analyzing, that too is not established. Not established means not inherently existent, not independently existent. In general, all objects of knowledge are subsumed within the class of either objects or minds. Object or subject. Furthermore, since the mind in its generality has already been examined, you should think Certainly nothing is established primordially as possessing substantial reality. So again, that means that we now come to realize that nothing is established to exist inherently or independently. That's what it means, possessing substantial reality. It just means to exist independently, inherently. Free the mind of conceptualization in this manner and release it in this state of non-grasping at intrinsic nature in terms of any of the three times. Three times just means past, present, future. Focus the mind with ease, lucidity, and vibrancy, not allowing it to fall under the influence of either dullness or excitation. So what this is saying is that when we investigate and we come to see that whatever we're investigating is not existing independently, the experience, of course, is this experience of not finding the independent me or the independent body or whatever we were looking for. And then it says to focus the mind with ease, lucidity, and vibrancy, not allowing it to fall under the influence of either dullness or excitation. Which means that once we get to this point of not finding, then we hold that experience as long as we can. That's an experience of emptiness. And what we want to do, of course, is allow that experience to penetrate deeper into our mind. So we hold that experience with a very clear, sharp focus. So therefore, we are effectively doing shamatha with emptiness as the object. And we are holding that as long as we can. And the more we can hold it, the more impact it will have on our mind. But often what happens is, particularly as a beginner, we try to do that. Maybe we get to the point of this not finding and we try and hold that experience. But then probably after a few seconds we get distracted or we just space out or fall half asleep or something. If that happens, then we go back, do the investigation again. And if we get to the point of not finding, then hold it again. And then it says, place your mind on the basis of all, the actual path. So here the basis of all can also be interpreted in at least two ways. So let's look at the commentary first and then comment a bit more. You should identify the ordinary mind. And here in the Kagyu tradition, the word ordinary mind is another word for the nature of the mind. And place it in a state free of negation or affirmation. A state free of negation or affirmation means a mind free of conceptualization, of grasping or attachment or aversion. Because what we're wanting to do here is when we get to this point of an experience of emptiness, we hold that experience as much as we can. We want to be able to hold that without discursiveness, without getting caught up in any attachment, aversion, or this here it's called affirmation or negation. Since all seven types of consciousness are conceptual minds, relinquish them. Here I'm not 100% sure when it talks about the seven types of consciousness, but often within the Kagyu and Nyingma school, well, in general, one way of dividing up the mind or consciousness is into six. Because we can experience six types of object. We can experience visual objects, sounds, taste, smell, tactile sensations. So we can experience the five sense objects, but also, of course, we can experience mental objects like thoughts, emotions, memories. So since we can experience six types of objects, we can talk about six types of consciousness. So we can talk about the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. So example here, of course, the visual consciousness is responsible for apprehending visual objects and so forth. But of course, here we're not talking about six separate minds. There's only one mind, there's only one consciousness. These are six aspects of the one mind. But here we talk about seven. In fact, I think it's coming from a presentation of eight. Often, and this comes also in the Chittamatra philosophical system, but it's also a presentation that's often adopted or used in the Kagyu and the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, is a presentation of eight consciousnesses. And they add to the six. They often add what's called the mind basis of all, which is sort of a little bit what's being referred to here in the basis of all. And also they add what's called afflicted mentality. And this is often added, particularly this mind basis of all, is added often to explain how our imprints, particularly karmic imprints, where they're stored and how they're transmitted. So they often say that the mind basis of all is where the karmic imprints are stored. And then the afflicted mentality is then described as the aspect of the mind which grasps onto this as being the person. Again? The afflicted mentality is an aspect of the mind that is said to take this mind basis of all as a basis and grasp onto it as being the person. So it's an afflicted state of mind. So there, sometimes then we have this eight consciousness presentation. And here it talks about seven consciousnesses being conceptual. Generally it said that these five are non-conceptual. But here, if we're interpreting this in terms of the basis of all being the very subtle mind, then anything above that is not conceptual. So then I think here when it talks about place the mind in the basis of all, they're talking about not this basis of all, but the very subtle clear light mind. And then I think maybe what's referred to as the seven consciousnesses are these other seven, the five, the mental and the afflicted mentality. But I'm just speculating about that because I don't know, I haven't seen any commentary on that. So what it says here is the essential point is to avoid being tainted by the conceptualization of subject-object duality. So here in this Vipassana practice, and particularly when we're talking about trying to rest into this very subtle mind, is to let go of conceptualization. But in general, of course, in a realization of emptiness, when that realization of emptiness becomes a direct realization of emptiness, then that is a completely non-conceptual state. So subsequently, whenever conceptualization arises, by observing awareness with awareness, let it rest free within reality itself. Since this constitutes actual meditation of clear light, So here, clear light is another name for this very subtle mind. So we see here that in the commentary, that it's really talking about trying to rest in the nature of the mind by resting in the very subtle clear light mind. Keep your sessions short, intense but of short duration. Within one session, you can have many sub-sessions. As for the length of the meditation session, it is said that the best session should have a stable base and should end in a joyful state. Okay, a few things to say here. So if we go back to the original slogan, place your mind on the basis of all, the actual path. So here we can interpret this in two ways at least. Place your mind on the basis of all. One way of looking at basis of all, what is the basis of everything, is emptiness. Emptiness is the ultimate nature of everything. And sometimes poetically we say that things arise out of emptiness. So place your mind on the basis of all, the actual path, could be interpreted as, therefore, place your mind in that experience or realization of emptiness. That's the actual path. Because actually, we progress along the path through deepening our realization of emptiness. And so we're going to look at that right now, in fact. How, by placing our mind in that experience of emptiness, how that becomes the actual path. How do we progress in the path through experiencing and realizing emptiness? So for that, we can go to your Mahayana path chart at the back. As I said earlier, in any practice we go through sort of three stages. Using the Tibetan words, go nyam tok. So go is intellectual. So first we need to develop a map so we have a framework for the practice so that we know how to do the practice and how to interpret experiences. But then, of course, we need to go into the territory with the map. So we need to meditate and we can come to a nyam, a taste or experience of emptiness. And of course, the more stable and clear our mind is, the more we can have this taste or experience, and the more it can affect our mind outside of meditation. And that experience of emptiness may affect our mind for a short time after meditation, maybe a few minutes or hours, maybe even a few days. And during that time, as I already mentioned, generally our mind will be more calm, less mental afflictions, we'll feel more connected with others. But then it'll sort of wear off and we'll go back to square one. So what we want to do, of course, is make that stable, which is realization. So here then, we are to place the mind in the basis of all, the actual path. Place the mind in that experience of emptiness and we can progress along the path. And the Mahayana path here is divided into five stages, as we see. The first stage of the path is called the path of accumulation. So to enter the Mahayana path, we see number two there is we have to develop bodhicitta, of course. So when we have developed or cultivated bodhicitta, we enter the Mahayana path. It's a door of entry into the Mahayana path. So what does it mean to develop or cultivate bodhicitta to this point? Here it says uncontrived. Now, of course, we can sit down and maybe using this approach here in the mind training, this exchanging self with others, we can have for a little while this aspiration come up. Oh yes, I'd like to really achieve enlightenment to help liberate everyone else from suffering. We may be able to develop that for a short time. Maybe it'll be there for a few moments or a few minutes and then it's gone. This point is when we have developed that to the point where that motivation is there with us throughout the day. That it's something that spontaneously and continuously arises in our mind and it's motivating all of our activities in daily life. That's uncontrived bodhicitta. When we get to that point, we enter the Mahayana path, this path of accumulation. And of course, once we develop this bodhicitta, we are a bodhisattva. So here, we become bodhisattva. The word accumulation here means the two accumulations, merit and wisdom. Merit, of course, is virtue, the result of virtue. So we are engaging in the two wings of practice, the compassionate activities and the wisdom practice of emptiness. So we are working on both of those, and that's what the word accumulation means. Here, to enter the path, we have already achieved shamatha. Well, we could have achieved it before, but at least by this point, we have shamatha. Which means, when we're meditating on emptiness here, our mind is very stable, very clear. Which means when we have an experience of emptiness, that is a very profound experience, has a very strong impact on our mind, and lasts. And during that time, and after the meditation, due to the experience of emptiness, again, the mental afflictions are a lot reduced. And if a mental affliction comes up, it tends to be very weak and doesn't last very long. So we can really keep the lid a lot on the mental afflictions. But here, when we have a realization of emptiness, it's still conceptual. Which means that even here, when we're experiencing emptiness, in meditation, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing emptiness. So we're experiencing emptiness in a dualistic, a conceptual way, via a mental image. So because there's still a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing this, having this experience of emptiness. And then as we move along this point, and even at this point, when we meditate, we have to sort of, what's said, alternate shamatha and vipassana. Because whenever we investigate, that sort of destabilizes the mind a bit. So if it destabilizes the mind too much, we stop investigating and go back to shamatha. So we sort of alternate between shamatha and vipassana. But when we get to the end of the path of accumulation, and the second stage is called preparation. at this point here, our investigation, our Vipassana practice, doesn't destabilize our attention, it enhances it. And then Shamatha and Vipassana become unified. And we saw that a little bit in the Shamatha chart. We go back one page. In the Shamatha chart, when we talked about the Vipassana practice up here, it said the root of samsara is cut by the union of Shamatha and Vipassana observing emptiness. So that union of Shamatha and Vipassana happens here. So we see that as number four. Number four, the union of Shamatha and Vipassana observing emptiness. So now Shamatha and Vipassana become unified. And the word preparation here is we're preparing for our first direct realization of emptiness. So even on the path of preparation, when we're realizing emptiness, it's still conceptual because there's still a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing this emptiness. But as we move along this path of preparation, this apparent duality between me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object, starts to collapse. And at the end of the path of preparation, it completely collapses. And we enter the path of seeing. And here we have a non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness. That now, in our experience of emptiness, there's no longer a sense of me, the meditator. There's just the experience of emptiness. And when we first have this direct realization of emptiness, we become known as an Arya. There are two types of practitioner, ordinary and Arya. An Arya practitioner is anyone who has had a direct realization of emptiness. So here on the Mahayana path, we entered here, we became a Bodhisattva, and when we get to the path of seeing here, we become an Arya Bodhisattva. We have had a direct realization of emptiness now. One direct realization of emptiness. Oh, before that, the conceptual realization of emptiness was only strong enough to keep the lid on the mental afflictions, to subdue them. It wasn't strong enough to wipe them out. Now, from the path of seeing, because it's a direct realization of emptiness, now it's powerful enough to start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions. But one realization, direct realization of emptiness, is not enough to wipe out all ignorance and mental afflictions. We have to keep doing that again and again and again and again.
You mean that it doesn't stay?
It stays, but it's not powerful enough to wipe out all the ignorance. Only a little bit.
So you come back to the ordinary state of mind?
No.
No?
What do you mean by ordinary state of mind?
Well, which was that was before the realization of emptiness.
No. Of course, this realization of emptiness is only happening in meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So we meditate, we have a direct realization of emptiness, and in meditation, because of that direct realization of emptiness, here, the first time, a little bit of ignorance and mental afflictions are wiped out. Then we come out of the meditation, and then we know that you had a direct realization of emptiness, and now you know in direct experience that the way things are appearing to you is not how they exist. There's no way now anyone can convince you that it's not that like that, because you've seen directly the fact that things are not existing as they appear. But we still need to continue to meditate and realize emptiness again and again and again to wipe out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions to achieve nirvana. That's what we do on the path of meditation, which normally is divided into nine. And those nine stages, together with the path of seeing, together those 10 are called the 10 grounds or 10 bhumis in Sanskrit. And what we are doing on the path of meditation, and remember the word meditation is coming from the Sanskrit word bhavana, and bhavana literally means to familiarize. So what we're doing here is we're familiarizing ourselves again and again and again with the direct realization of emptiness that we first achieved here. So we're meditating on emptiness, realizing it again, 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 and at each stage wiping out more and more layers of ignorance and mental afflictions. When we get to the end of the seventh ground, we have now wiped out all ignorance and mental afflictions, and so therefore we've achieved the goal of nirvana. But remember, our goal is enlightenment, so we still have these cognitive obscurations, these subtle stains of ignorance in our mind. So over the 8th, 9th and 10th ground, again through meditating on emptiness, realizing it directly again and again, we start to wipe out these subtle stains of ignorance. And at the end of the 10th ground, we sit down for the last time, meditate on emptiness, wipe out the last subtle stain of ignorance in our mind. In the very next moment, the whole world appears to us, and we're still realizing emptiness directly. And then we achieve enlightenment, we become Buddha, and this is called the path of no more learning. So an enlightened being is someone who can see the phenomenal world and be realizing emptiness simultaneously. Before that, we are either in meditation, absorbed in emptiness, and nothing else is appearing, or we're seeing the phenomenal world. So we have to alternate. Mm. But when we achieve enlightenment, it becomes simultaneous. We see the phenomenal world, and we see emptiness directly, simultaneously, when we achieve enlightenment. So that's very briefly the Mahayana path. A lot more to be said about that, but maybe that's enough for now. Any questions about that?
Who has written this down? I mean, it has to be someone who has gone the path, because it just
exactly.
So who has...
Well, all the great masters from the past, through their own experience, this is what they report, and then they map out these stages. Now, what we need to remember, of course, is that this is operating within the coarse level of mind, the one we have now. So we refine that with shamatha, and we use that in vipassana. And then this is sort of the way the process. If, of course, at any point we jump into Tantra, then it looks very different. Because in Tantra Vajrayana, we're accessing the very subtle mind. And that's much more powerful than this mind. So also in Tantra, they have some mapping of what it sort of looks like if you're using that level of mind. But again, if you sort of start on this and then you go into the Tantra, then it won't really look like this, because you're going into the very subtle mind, and then you can really accelerate things, and things are a little bit different than what this looks like. But you still have to go through the process of having a direct realization of emptiness, wiping out ignorance and so forth. I mean, it's still the same mechanism, but how quickly and what is a little bit different at the level of Tantra or Vajrayana. Any other questions about
that? And the result would be the same.
Same. Having said that, actually, if you talk to the sort of tantric people, they'll say this, using the coarse mind, achieving enlightenment, you're not going to make it. Because what they say is that these stains that we eliminate here at the end, these subtle stains in the mind, they say that the coarse mind is not powerful enough to get rid of them, the most subtle of those. They say that at some point you'll need to gain access to the very subtle mind to finish the job. But you can progress a long way, maybe even up to like the 10th ground, but a long way in the sutra path. But then at some point the tantrika people say that you have to shift into gaining access to the very subtle mind to sort of finish the job. But of course, if we're here, to do that is like very easy. Very easy, so it's not a problem anyway.
Would you be doing the same method of analysis into emptiness, or would you be changing them throughout the process?
Well, once we get down into here, what we're doing, well, here direct realization is you're not really going through any much analysis now because you've had a direct realization. You're just bringing that to mind again and just sitting in that experience. I mean, early on, of course, to establish emptiness, we're doing more analysis. But as the further we go, you'll find that the less analysis and the more you're just sort of you very quickly, when you sort of look at the person, very quickly that experience will arise. You won't have to go through the more extensive search because of your previous experience. And then eventually it'll just become no real analysis. It's just, you just recall that experience and rest in it.
But in the beginning, you would start by investigating the mind and the person.
Well, the mind or the person or whatever, yeah. Exactly. Otherwise, you know, of course we can sit there and space out, but yeah. It's not going to help. Yeah.
Do we need 5,000 hours per stage?
Now we start counting.
How many hours?
How long is a piece of string?
Is the distance the same for everybody?
Yeah. Again, it depends where we... Remember, we shouldn't think this is the starting point. You know? I mean, if we get to this point, we're already, like, way, way on the path. This is not the starting blocks. Because often people go, oh, I haven't even started. This is the entry point to the Mahayana path. These points are very easily, clearly defined milestones that we can see. I mean, of course, before here, there's a lot of progress we can make. I mean, if you get to here, that's already, like, amazing.
Life is great.
I mean, yeah, if you're here, life is great already. I mean, it's, like, incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So after path of seeing, you don't go back. You go on.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's often talk about this sort of irreversibility. And often there are different assertions that I've seen in different texts, but generally this is the one that is sort of really pointed to. It often says if you get to the direct realization of emptiness here, you're on a one-way ticket out. Usually that's what's said in the text.
Fall back.
Yeah, that's right.
My ego is not happy because my ego identifies itself with Mahayana, so my ego says, this is all... I'm not even on this chart. Couldn't we draw the same chart? Like beginner's Mahayana
path? So where we are.
Having visited Kopang or having visited Kushida.
Okay, just for you.
Over here. It's there, right?
So then you can make stages like... having read a book about Buddhism, having heard somebody talk,
true. But I mean, the fact that you're even sitting in this room means you've, like, if you look at the big picture, to be in this room, even trying to listen to this, you're already, like, a long way ahead of a lot of other people. I mean, really, seriously.
It's just the ego.
Yeah, of course.
Is it satisfied? You
go. Yes, you are. I think I tried not to listen to it too much.
Okay. Any more questions about this?
Yes. Okay. Let's say the me that appears as the accumulation of the parts. Yeah? Like. Me is the label for the accumulation of the parts. And this me starts the journey.
Right.
Starts the path.
Right. And that me then will change because the body changes and the mind changes.
Yeah, all the way.
All the way.
Uh-huh. So, the question is, who really is trying to get liberated? Who tries to get enlightenment?
The me that's merely labelled on the body and the mind.
This label.
The dependent me. No, it's not a label. We're not a label.
Not there.
A person is not a label. A bowl is not a label.
But because it can be a ball, it can be a piece of metal. It may be called different way.
Yeah. We can call also, we can call this a body.
Yeah.
We can call this a chest.
Yeah.
We can call it skin. Uh-huh. We can call it many things.
Yeah. But okay, and when this me starts the journey for enlightenment, let's say it gets changed on the way. It becomes different. So you say
it becomes different every day, whether we're going to enlightenment or not.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, me is changing always.
Yeah. I mean, but the real difference, it's like
the real difference.
The mind, the realization of emptiness, the first, yeah.
The real difference, of course, is that the mind is transforming,
mm-hmm.
and we're purifying the mind of mental afflictions. That's the big difference. But it's still changing.
But how it will be right to say, like, the mind is trying to purify itself, or the me, which is just
you can say
identified consciousness, trying to
purify the mind.
To purify.
Both are okay. Both are okay. I mean, don't we say, I'm going to walk to the kitchen to get a cup of tea? Can't we say that my body is walking to the kitchen? Both are okay. No problem.
Okay, there is two states, for instance. Ordinary state and the state in meditation. Like the one who is progressed enough in the path, still, like Bodhisattva, Arya Bodhisattva, still can eat the meditation because in meditation he is realizing emptiness.
Correct.
In ordinary life, he is experiencing the world as any other person.
No, absolutely not. Because when you've had a direct realization of emptiness, you know directly that these appearances are, that things are not existing as they appear. So an Arya Bodhisattva, it'd be virtually impossible for them to have craving or aversion to pleasant and unpleasant things. It's like they're in a lucid dream. Because they've realized emptiness, they're in a lucid dream now. The world will still appear to exist independent of them, but they know, because they've realized emptiness, that things are not like existing like that. So it doesn't really cause them a problem. For us, it causes a problem, because we grasp onto them in this way. Okay, let's break, have a cup of tea, come back at 3:30, and we'll continue on.